session was recorded live at the Evangelical Theological Society's 50th anniversary meeting, held November 19th through the 21st, 1998, in Orlando, Florida.
Paragraphs there to back up his statement. And perhaps in the last hour I should have endorsed tongue speaking, and we'd have a larger crowd here for the second hour. Why don't we begin? This, as I said, is the second part of a package deal. The first part of the package was given in the last hour, called the Educational Establishment versus Civilization. And I concluded that statement by arguing that, agreeing with Lippmann in one sense, that we have to rethink all of education. Let me pick up at that point. Perhaps the biggest temptation for educational reformers is to tinker. There are two sorts of tinkers, conservative and liberal. The conservative tinker says, if only we could get sex education out of the schools, if only we could get phonics back in, if only children could pray in school, if only we can stop outcome-based education, if only we could raise SAT scores, if only we had testing for teachers. The latest form of conservative tinkering is vouchers, the moral and economic equivalent of food stamps for schools. Then there are liberal tinkers. If only we could get more tax money for schools. If only we could pay teachers more. If only we had federal standards for students. If only we could get outcome-based education into the schools. If only we had more sex education. If only we had more federal regulations. If only our schools were truly integrated and multicultural. Of course, there are some things liberal and conservative tinkers agree on. If only we could have magnet or charter schools. If only we could reduce dropout rates and have smaller classes. And more recently, if only we could get moral values back in the schools. Conservatives and many professed Christians rally around values and faith. They seek a broad coalition of people of faith on behalf of religion. But they tend to mumble when asked what values they would like to see taught in the schools, and they give only tradition as the source of values. William Bennett of the Roman Catholic Campaign for America and former Secretary of Education has made a small fortune advancing his traditionalist and classical Christian view of values in such eclectic books as the Book of Virtues. But Christianity is distinguished from Roman Catholicism, liberal Protestantism, and neo-evangelicalism, neither has nor seeks friends in other religions and other faiths. Christianity is the rejection in toto of other religions and philosophies. It claims to have a systemic monopoly on truth. Those churchgoers who do not agree either do not understand what Christianity is, or they reject its explicit claims to exclusivity. In either case, they are traveling under false colors. 70 years ago, J. Gresham Machen warned against values education in secular schools. There is something radically wrong, Machen said, with our public education, it is said. An education that trains the mind without training the moral sense is a menace to civilization rather than a help, and something must be quickly done to check the impending moral collapse. To meet this need, various provisions are being made for moral training in our American public schools. Various ethical codes are being formed for the instruction of children who are under the care of the state. But the sad thing is that these efforts are only making the situation tenfold worse. Far from checking the ravages of immorality, they are for the most part themselves non-moral at root. Machen went on to explain that the only basis for morality is the law of God. Morality cannot be based on the experience of men or of the race, nor on the speculations of philosophers, nor on the revelations of other prophets, nor on church doctrine, but on biblical revelation alone. Any attempt to base values education in something other than biblical revelation, said Machen, is immoral, irrational, and anti-Christian. Character Counts is simply the latest attempt to inculcate a non-Christian morality in the public schools. It was proposed and is supported by those who want some sort of civic morality, but reject the only theology that can logically support civilization. Religious convictions per se will not save our educational system. There are some who say, and many more who believe, that it doesn't matter what one believes, for all that is important is that one's belief be sincere. President Dwight Eisenhower once said, "Our government makes no sense unless it is founded in a deeply felt religious faith, and I don't care what it is." But sincerity and religious conviction are worthless without truth. It is not sincerity but truth that counts. Sincerity, far from being all-important, has importance only if truth is believed. If error is sincerely believed, it will prove harmful, not helpful. The same with faith. There is no magic in faith. There is no magic in believing. The notion is pure paganism. More than a century ago, Matthew Arnold wrote a poem, Dover Beach, about the ebbing of faith in the modern world, which concludes, "Was the sea of faith was once too at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy long withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind, down the vast ages drear and naked shingles of the world. Ah, love, let us be true to one another, for the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain, and we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggles and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night." The world that Arnold saw, without joy, love, light, certitude, peace, and help for pain, was not that way because generic faith was ebbing, but because Christianity was ebbing. What has made the West as good as it is, that is, what has prevented the West from being as bad as some other cultures, is not some non-Christian values or minimalist version of Christianity, but the full, consistent Christianity of the Protestant reformers, a Christianity whose philosophy has been completely articulated only in the 20th century. The history of education in America is the history of the decline of education from the Calvinism of its founders in 1636 through Arminianism and Unitarianism to atheism. The college that the Puritans began within 16 years of their first landing in the wilderness had more sound education in it than most built since then. Today we face a new wilderness, not an uninhabited geographical wilderness, but a cultural and spiritual wilderness. It is our job as Christian educators to tame the wilderness by building a shining university on a hill. Already, Christian parents are removing their children from government schools and educating them at home and in Christian schools. That movement, which still has a long way to go, is well underway. It will not have succeeded until the last public school is sold to the highest bidder, and no government, federal, state, or local, spends any money on education. But long before that happens, we must offer the graduates of these Christian schools and home schools a Christian university. Unfortunately, some putatively Christian writers have attacked higher education, saying that the next generation of Christians should be taught a trade. They should not pursue the illusion of college degrees, and certainly not advanced degrees. They need something practical instead. These anti-intellectuals, some of whom sport PhDs, deprecate diplomas and advanced degrees. This Amish view of education is both anti-Christian and suicidal. Any parent who listens to them is sealing the fate of his child. But where are Christian parents to send their children? There is no Christian university in the United States. Yesterday, Dr. Carson was speaking about the possibility of starting one. And he was considering and mulling that over and musing about that in his lecture. If you haven't heard the lecture, I urge you to listen to it. There are plenty of colleges that masquerade as Christian, but none of them makes Christian philosophy control every classroom. It is our job to create that Christian university so that the next generation of Christians, instead of being overwhelmed by or compromising with the world, will be equipped to take on the world in every field of endeavor and win. The place to begin building a Christian university is defining by what we mean by education. There have been three principal views put forth over the centuries: the vocational, the informational, and the philosophical. According to the vocational view, the purpose of education is to equip children for life, to give them a way of earning a living. This, of course, includes more than manual training schools in which one might learn to become a carpenter or a plumber. Most of the graduate schools today, theological seminaries, law schools, engineering schools, music schools, medical schools, dental schools, business schools, are vocational schools. Their purpose is to equip the student for a career. It is a serious mistake to confuse such vocational training with education. Graduates of these schools are doctors, dentists, corporate managers, lawyers, clerics. They are not necessarily educated men. Technical proficiency must not be confused with education, as Dewey did. The graduates of our professional schools each has his own specialty, but they lack the understanding that characterizes an educated man. Martin Luther understood the dependence of the practical men on the scholars. In his essay on the duty of sending children to school, he wrote, "Pay no attention to the contempt which the ordinary devotee of mammon manifests for culture, so that he says, 'Well, if my son can read, write, and cipher, that is enough, for I am going to make a merchant out of him.' Without scholars, it would not be long until businessmen in their perplexity would be ready to dig a learned man out of the ground 10 yards deep with their fingers. For the merchant will not long remain a merchant if preaching and the administration of justice cease. I know full well that we theologians and jurists must remain, or else all other vocations will inevitably go to the ground with us. Where theologians perish, there perishes also the word of God, and nothing but heathen and devils are left. When jurists perish, there perish also law and peace, and nothing remains but robbery, murder, outrage, and force, the reign of wild beasts. But what the merchant will gain when peace vanishes, I shall let his ledger tell him. And the use of all his property when preaching ceases, let his conscience show him." For the same reason, the second view of education, the informational view, which is a big step up from the vocational view, must also be rejected. That view is reflected in books such as E.D. Hirsch's Cultural Literacy, which became a bestseller a few years ago and spawned a school of imitators. In his book, Hirsch catalogs all the data that an educated American should know to function in American society. While having such facts at one's fingertips may be an important qualification for playing Jeopardy, it does not constitute an education. A person may be knowledgeable, he may be learned, without being educated. Just as the training of the hands and eyes for brain surgery does not constitute an education, neither does the memorization of 10,000 bits of information. It is good, of course, to have such information at one's fingertips. A well-stocked mind is a thing to be desired. But having the information in mind is not the same as having an education. The Major General in Gilbert's and Sullivan's Pirates of Penzance was well informed, far more so than today's high school or college graduates, but he was not educated. And I will not sing this. "I am the very model of a modern Major General. I have information vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England, and I quote the fights historical from Marathon to Waterloo in order categorical. I am very well acquainted, too, with matters mathematical. I understand equations, both the simple and quadratical. About binomial theorems, I'm teeming with a lot of news, with many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse." American schools and colleges would be much better if they turned out graduates with the knowledge like of the Major General. But if that were all they did, they would still be failing at education. The only satisfactory view of education is the philosophical view. which includes both the learning of information and prepares one for the practical matter of earning a living. But education goes far beyond vocational training and the memorization of data to understanding the meaning and significance of the data and arranging them in a logical system. The philosophical view defines education as understanding. In biblical language, one has knowledge, but one also has understanding or wisdom. Wisdom or understanding is seeing how pieces of knowledge fit together. It is seeing the whole picture and understanding how each part of the picture is related to the whole. It is the whole that gives meaning to the parts. It is the whole that tells us what is more important, what is less important, and what isn't important at all. In summary, one may be knowledgeable and learned. He may be a star on Jeopardy and be neither trained nor educated. One may be well-trained. He may be the world's foremost brain surgeon or pianist and be neither learned nor educated. But the educated man has mastered his most important and flexible tool, his intelligence, and he has a well-stocked mind. He knows where to find the myriad facts he needs, and he knows how to use his intelligence to attack any problem that might arise. To quote Milton's Tractate on Education, "I call therefore a complete and generous education that which fits a man to perform justly, skillfully, and magnanimously all the offices of both private and public, of peace and war." Education results in a disciplined and flexible intelligence that is the most useful tool of all. Far from being useless, as the vocationalists charge, a Christian education is the most useful discipline. Those things most useless, the impractical subjects, the philosophy and theology courses, turn out to be the most useful, after all. Apart from this sort of education, a philosophical education, the specialists, the scientists, engineers, lawyers, doctors, live in their own worlds, not knowing what medicine has to do with law or literature. When they meet in social situations, they talk about the weather or sports or the latest political scandal. The latter, of course, ensures that they do not lack for topics of conversation. But they cannot carry on a significant or sustained conversation because they live in different universes, despite having been to the university. Specialization, which can and should be a good thing, for it allows us to concentrate our limited energies, select the field that interests us, and make a significant contribution to that field, becomes harmful. Specialization can be good only if one first knows where his specialty fits into the overall scheme of things, only if the specialist has a worldview. Specialization need not be harmful, provided the proper basis is laid for it. On the contrary, specialization is valuable. Specialization can allow one to develop those habits of mind that can be carried over into other disciplines. Orderliness, thoroughness, honesty, rigor, clarity, precision, and cogency. Specialization is not only valuable, it is inevitable. It is impossible to master the whole of learning. It is impossible for a chemist, for example, even to master all of chemistry. Given the quantity of information available, we all must specialize. There's the old story of the professor of Greek who cried, "I have wasted my energies. I have devoted my life to the study of the ablative and the dative. Why didn't I specialize? I should have concentrated on the ablative and left the dative alone." The Apostle Paul makes several points about specialization by demonstrating that Christians, as members of the body of Christ, are all specialists. Some are eyes, some hands, some feet. Some are elders, some deacons, some homemakers are hospitable to angels. But the only reason such specialization is and can be good is that Christians do not specialize in doctrine. We all have the same mind, the mind of Christ. Thus, while Paul encourages a diversity of gifts, activities, and congregations, he does not encourage a diversity of doctrine. In Paul's school, there is divine election, but there are no electives. There is, rather, a rigorous systematic theology summarized for us in his letter to the Romans. It is common to hear that we must have a worldview, but if that is where the argument stops, it is inadequate. There's no magic in having a worldview, just as there is none in having faith or religion. What is important is having the right worldview, the true worldview. The primacy of truth is most important. Education does not consist in the quest for truth. Education is, rather, the communication of truth from one generation to another. Most of the private colleges in America were established by Christians and were originally founded on that principle, yet few of those colleges remain Christian today. More than 30 years ago, in 1966, in a major study of church-sponsored higher education in the United States, the study concluded that the intellectual presuppositions which actually guide the activities of most church colleges are heavily weighted in the secular direction. The situation is worse today. How is a college to avoid, or at least postpone, such a fate, which indeed is a fate worse than death? Perhaps we should look more closely at what the Puritans did, discarding their errors and improving their insights. After all, the Puritans are the only significant group of Christians in America who have attempted a Christian reconstruction of thought. At Harvard College, the student was clearly informed that, quote, the main end of his life and studies is to know God and Jesus Christ, and therefore to lay Christ in the bottom as the only foundation of all sound knowledge and learning. I had the opportunity earlier this year to speak up at Harvard. And when I read that quote, the students were amazed that this is what the charter of Harvard College said. They were completely unaware of it. The Harvard statement is the principle of sola scriptura applied to education. Notice the words only and all. The Harvard statement excludes all appeals to observation, experience, nature, science, and secular philosophy. Many professed Christians today might initially agree with the Harvard statement, only to run after strange gods, psychology, science, the classic secular philosophy, no sooner than the statement had passed through their minds. They honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. It is important to have a worldview, but it is far more important to have the correct worldview. Only the correct worldview will provide a thoroughly Christian education, equip a new generation to proclaim, explain, and defend the Christian faith in the 21st century, and eventually create a new civilization, rising from the ruins of the old. For the past 20 years, we have developed and published the ideas, the system of ideas, the Christian philosophy on which any new civilization must be built. These ideas have been outlined and articulated by Gordon Clark, the philosopher of the Reformation. Some other organizations have glimpsed a part of the system, but not the whole. To the extent that they have lacunae in their philosophies or have compromised with the world, they must fail at perpetuating and defending the faith. The case for Christianity must be watertight. If there is an open seam anywhere, it may prove to be the fatal gap. The basic curriculum is ready. What we must do is develop the mechanism to develop it to the upcoming generation of students, to deliver it to the upcoming generation of students. The students who have been educated at home or in Christian schools must be told that there is an entire world of Christian thought, that they ought not to be satisfied with the secularism of the state universities or their cousins, the private and Christian colleges, that they do not have to settle for a humanist higher education. Like the Puritans, we face a vast wilderness. Do we, like them, have the understanding and the vision and the courage to establish a Christian university? In his comments yesterday, Dr. Carson kept coming back to the same theme. Actually, he had several themes he kept returning to, but one was money. He pointed out, for example, that Princeton Seminary, its students attend free because of the large endowment of Princeton Seminary. If you go to his seminary, Trinity, and you borrow the money to attend, you come out with a large debt. And this is very common in higher education today. I personally have known students who have gone to Christian colleges, have been taken advantage of by the loan programs, and emerged from those colleges with a debt of $40,000, $50,000. That is a burden that young people starting out in life should not face. But the colleges are encouraging that, encouraging students to go into debt. Are there any comments or questions about my remarks or anything else? Yes, sir.
This doesn't seem likely to happen very quickly. Can you have more specific things that can be done where we are right now? Like in a Christian school, I send my kids to families, or what we can do for assisting our children to go to college on how to make decisions, what's in case, where to go.
I think as parents, we have the duty of ensuring that our children are both educated and unencumbered by debt when they get their education. And I think it's important for us to make the investments, to make the savings that will be required to pay for their education. One of the reasons the public school system has been so popular is that it seems to be free. We can compel other people to pay for our kids' education. Now, it's true, we pay our own property tax, but that is probably, in many cases, a fraction of what that education actually costs. So we have, through the ballot box, we have gone to the polls and forced our neighbor to pay for our children's education. What we would not do in private life, none of us would think of going to our neighbor and saying, I've got three kids that need an education, and I'm here to collect $1,000 from you this year. But it's entirely permissible in our way of thinking to do that through the ballot box. One of the things we ought to do is support any movement for the elimination of tax funding of schools. We ought to support any movement for the sale of public schools. And defund them. If people want to have a public school, then it should be funded by a user fee, not by subsidy from the general tax funds. Let those who attend pay for it. Certainly don't impose a tax on everyone. As far as the curriculum in Christian schools, I would make it mandatory for Christian school teachers who frequently have just graduated from the departments of education or the schools of education and haven't the foggiest idea what education is about, to read some good books on education. I think it's very important that the teachers be educated in Christian schools. Many of them come out of the schools and departments of education thinking now they have the tools that they need. They haven't the tools at all. Make reading a book like Clark's Christian Philosophy of Education mandatory, or Machen on Education. Thomas Sowell on Education. He's not a Christian, but he sees some of the major problems with the system, including the system of thought that governs public education. That, I think, is important, to educate the teachers. And the parents there, again, may have the primary responsibility of doing so. Any other comments or questions? Yes, it is. Christian Philosophy of Education. And Machen's book, Trinity Foundation. We have a commercial announcement here. Machen's book is Education, Christianity, and the State. He did not actually write it as a book. It's a collection of his essays and speeches that I collected and edited. And one of the fascinating things about that book is in 1926, I think I mentioned it somewhere in these talks, Machen is appearing before a joint committee of Congress in opposition to a federal Department of Education. Now, this is over 70 years ago. We think of these issues as somehow just surfacing in the past 25 years. Not at all. And he's writing about values education 70 years ago. You know, it's as contemporary as one could expect. And he points out that if the values education isn't based on revelation, it's anti-Christian. Yes, sir?
I have a question. Now, I apologize for this late, and this is for part of the question. You may have addressed it. I'm over to it. What if you're in a setting where, historically, when colleges, Christian colleges, Bible colleges, and so forth, have moved to the next step of a university structure, traditionally, historically, you know, I guess we would be concerned like they've gone liberal and so forth. Are there any cautions, any, but other than just warnings, like pragmatic or practical things to consider?
Well, the question, as I understand it, is what advice could I give on when a Christian Bible college has moved to the next organizational step and become a university or something? It depends on what aspect you're asking it from, I suppose. If you're a potential contributor, I'd say give nothing for construction. If the college has, or the university has good faculty, give them money to pay the faculty, but give nothing to those institutions that will stand there and be misused in the future. Give money to pay the faculty, the good faculty at whatever institution is there. Now, if you're looking at it from a different perspective, from the student, probably the best you're going to do is, excuse me, what probably most of us did, what I did when I was a student, I chose a college to go to, not based on the reputation of the college, but based solely on the reputation of one or two faculty members with whom I wanted to study.
What about the guarding of the gates as far as faculty?
How to do that? Well, there's...
I mean, obviously that's an administrative...
And it's a very important question. I would have the college adopt a statement of faith, a doctrine, a creed, whatever you want to call it, and require the faculty and administration and board publicly each year to sign it at a convocation of the college. I would have the administration of the college, the president of the college, reiterate it constantly, what the college is here for, what it stands for, what its purpose is, what its doctrine is. And if this is done constantly, if you have an annual signing of the statement, public. I'm not talking about something done in the president's office. Public signing of everyone. And you make the announcement to the students, if you hear a deviation from this, from our faculty members, feel free to correct them. This will encourage, I think it will take care of the problem of apostasy. At least it will lessen it. Because those people who are having doubts about the statement of faith will tend to resign. They will get tired of hearing it repeated. They will get finally perhaps a little uncomfortable signing a statement that they have reservations about or disagree with publicly.
In an ideal world.
Yes. Well, the idea is to make it public and to see that everyone is mutually held accountable for it. Yes, sir.
One of the things that has struck me as a fairly new Christian, I have a PhD in psychology, and I decided, I was a burned out psychologist, and a research psychologist, but not interested very much in that. I went into the Christian university, and I looked at the textbooks, the same textbooks that I rejected on moral grounds, and I wasn't a Christian. And I talked to him, why did he use the same book if that's all that's available? Now, it seems to me that if I were to teach psychology now, I would teach it entirely differently. The whole orientation, starting from what is the science down to the application of psychology, would be completely different. And I would think psychology would be subordinate to doctrine. My impression is that is not the case. It's not just psychology. I'm not thinking about psychology. It's probably true in history and economics and everything. But I don't understand it because it would seem to me that books available or people are looking for an attempt to integrate all the learning material in the university under this heading of the doctrine. It's not that at all, it's present.
Thank you very much for the comment. I'm glad to hear I'm not alone in that impression. The comment was, the gentleman said he recently became a Christian, and he has a PhD in psychology, and after he became a Christian, he noticed that the textbooks used in Christian colleges were the same textbooks that he had rejected on moral grounds before he was a Christian. And he's wondering why this is so. Well, one of the reasons, if I can express an opinion here, I think one of the reasons is that many who profess Christ do not understand that he claims, what shall we say, lordship over every thought. We are to bring every thought into captivity to Christ, and that includes psychology. They have this idea that we can make do with, over here we can have, and it's not just psychology, as you pointed out, it's every discipline. We can have the secular thought over here, and it's fine. We'll keep the Christianity in the religion department or the Bible department or whatever. And they call this integration. It's not integration whatsoever. I taught at a so-called Christian college for about 3 years. And that was one of the most appalling things I noticed at the college was the textbooks that were being used. They were indistinguishable from what was being used in the state university across the street. This is a small, private Christian college. Same textbooks. One could go to the state university and pay one-tenth in tuition, what the students were paying at the Christian college, and get the same instruction. What's the point of it? Why pay 10 times as much for an education when you can have the same basic instruction at a state university? Unless Christians develop the idea that the Bible speaks to every discipline and ought to control every discipline, that situation will remain. And it's a terrible situation. In my first talk, I made the comment, somewhat facetious, that if the laws against fraud that apply to businesses applied to Christian colleges, the jails would be full of administrators and faculty from Christian colleges, because they have a label on the bottle, but what is in the bottle is not what's labeled. If a businessman tried that, he would never get out of prison. In fact, they had, if I could continue, they had a suit recently, or within the past couple of years, maybe somebody knows about it. It was Bethel College. Is that in Minnesota? Is that the Bethel in Minnesota? You probably know more about it than I do. But there you had parents upset because the college represented itself as a Christian college, and in the English department, apparently one of the faculty members was requiring the reading of pornography. And they tried to hold the college accountable. They met with the administration. Of course, we're not going to do anything. Academic freedom. Nobody understands what that means either. But they trotted out academic freedom as the defense here. Finally, the parents ended up going to court, I believe. And they lost in court, unfortunately. But they did bring a suit against the college for misrepresentation. And perhaps if a few more donors and parents did that, it might call the administrations of our colleges and the faculties of our colleges to heel.
Is there any university that you know of that you would call them Christian or close?
Not thoroughly. As I say, there are good faculty in many institutions, and the best you can do if you're looking for a higher education is to go study with a faculty member. Rather than picking out an institution, I don't think you're going to find an institution that is thoroughly Christian. Yes, sir.
How much doctrinal uniformity does there need to be before we would call it a Christian university? For instance, I mean, you talk about Dr. Harper's statement the other day. Would you be comfortable with him designing a university and a curriculum with his theological beliefs? Would you call that a Christian university?
You've got me on the spot here.
I struggle with that myself.
You've got me on the spot here because I can't say that I'm familiar with the details of his belief. I'd have to see what he produces. I might agree with him.
Wouldn't it be hard, though, for us to come to uniformity of beliefs?
That's why you had usually denominational colleges. Yes. Yes, sir.
Another thing that needs to be cultural pressure is done. Parents in the past seem to be committed to the idea of sending their children just to get that philosophy. You mentioned the three types of education, just to get that Christian worldview. But there's such a pressure in America today because of the materialism to say, what good is my kid going to have with a degree? You know, even with the Bible college, and I think that's one of the reasons for the demise of, or the decline in some of the Bible colleges, the parents are taking my kid is qualified to do nothing now. So from a pragmatic approach, I think we need to disseminate, as pastors and so forth, to communicate to our people that it is valuable to get a Christian worldview. But then they struggle with that tension of saying, yeah, but now I've spent all that money when my kid can't get a job because he hasn't had, as you call it, diversity of vocation. I don't know, I mean, you mentioned in the philosophical view, you said it includes learning of information and prepares for the practical matter of earning a living. But in doing so, it's almost as though you're saying, to do that, you're going to need a 5-year program.
Well, our 5-year program is one possibility. Let me ask a question here before I go on. Of those of you who have graduated from college, how many are working in the field that you studied in college? Okay, we have about 4 or 5 in the group that are actually working in the field, their major in college. Most people, or in this group, most people anyway, many people, switch. They declare a major in college and then perhaps work in that field for a short time and soon leave. Now, if they don't have the philosophical education, they're going to have to learn their new job, and they aren't equipped for the shift from one career to the other, one job to the other. It's been my experience, and perhaps you can think back on your own, that when you get a job, your first 6 months on the job are apprenticeship anyway. You don't know what you're doing. Even if you come out of Harvard Business School, you spend the first 6 months learning the business. And if that's the case, then what the college education ought to do for you is precisely what I've described. It ought to give you the tools you need to think clearly and cogently, to speak persuasively, to argue, to present your ideas. On the job training, you're expected to come out of medical school knowing something about medicine. But again, that's at the graduate level. And perhaps a 5-year program at the undergraduate level would be what's needed.
How would you contrast that to the model here for a Christian university than from a Bible college education? More general ed?
Yes, it wouldn't be. I'm not sure, I'm not that familiar with the curriculum of a Bible college, but you would take courses in philosophy. Yeah, the liberal arts. You'd take courses in history. You'd take courses in mathematics, some introductory courses in science, that sort of thing. Yes, sir.
That was interesting. Your comment, when I was in college, in undergraduate school in philosophy, there was an article one professor put up on the board from a call from the sheriff's department in some county in Colorado that was looking for PhDs in philosophy to hire as their criminal investigators.
Absolutely no training in those areas at all. But you had worldview, you had a thing, you had a reason, those kind of things. And like you said, look at your own job training, you wouldn't give a damn shot a gun, you laugh, you know, that interview you divided, if you have this kind of background, this is the person looking at you, I just want to say, but I think broadly that, you know, Michael Collins explained sort of like what you're saying there, this general ability to, that I agree, that's reason, I agree, and express yourself clearly, write a report that is legible. And intelligible. Those are things that are applicable in every field. And unless you can think clearly, unless you have the well-stocked mind, you're going to be useless.
And in our Bible colleges and all, a lot of times the education is merely vocational training. I mean, you haven't taught them a thing. You just taught them,
how to counsel.
Situations, they get out, they still can't think on their own.
That's right. You give them a course in counseling and a course in homiletics and rather than giving them an education. Any other comments? I think our time has expired. Thank you very much.